2 Kings chapter 22.
2 Kings 22.
We'll be finishing up 2 Kings in the next few weeks. Moving on to Proverbs for a little while, probably being Proverbs for a few weeks. We've been through Proverbs before, and if you stay in Proverbs for week after week after week after week, it gets pretty intense because there's so many changes of direction and all. It seems like you're not getting anywhere. So I just found it was best to do three or four chapters of Proverbs at a time and to go do something else for a while and then come back. So we'll leap off into Proverbs here after we get done with 2 Kings and stay with it a few weeks, and we'll see how that goes. All right, 2 Kings, though, tonight, 2 Kings chapter 22. In 2 Kings chapter 22, it's in the middle of Josiah's reign, and a lot of good things happened during Josiah's reign. As a little boy, he begins to seek the Lord, and then by the time, you know, he's grown and a few years into his kingship, he is becoming a better house cleaner than even Hezekiah. We stopped last time down around verses 13 or 14, and what Josiah has just received is the scribe has discovered, the high priest has discovered the word of the Lord in the house of God, and why nobody knew where it was before, nobody's quite sure, but that goes to show you that it doesn't take long to go down the slippery slope when you're without a Bible. Okay? And so here is Josiah, just a couple of generations after Hezekiah, and nonetheless raised without a Bible and all those things. And so they find this Bible, and the scribe stands up and reads the Bible, the law, in front of Josiah. And Josiah's first reaction after that, verse 11, 2 Kings 22:11. We'll just start there for now. It came to pass when the king had heard the words of the book of the law that he rent his clothes. And the king commanded Hilkiah the priest, and Ahikam the son of Shaphan, and Achbor the son of Micaiah, and Shaphan the scribe, and Azahiah a servant of the king, saying, Go ye inquire of the Lord for me, and for the people, and for all Judah concerning the words of this book that is found, for great is the wrath of the Lord that is kindled against us. I mean, a couple of things here. There is, you have to be impressed by the fact that having heard the word of God for the first time, he immediately accepts it as the truth. None of this, you know, mumbo-jumbo, seminary mumbo-jumbo. He immediately accepts it as the truth, takes immediate action, undertakes to immediately do what he can to repair the breach. And furthermore, at the end of verse 13, The wrath of the Lord is kindled against us because our fathers have not hearkened unto the words of this book. His attitude is not, well, why is God going to beat up on me because it's not my fault that my fathers were backslidden and da-da-da-da-da. I didn't feel like this was injustice on God's part. Verse 13 again at the end of the verse. Our fathers have not hearkened unto the words of this book and to do according unto all that which is written. Concerning us. So Hilkiah the priest and Ahikam and Achbor and Shaphan and Azahiah went unto Huldah the prophetess, the wife of Shallum, the son of Tikva, the son of Harhas, keeper of the wardrobe. Now she dwelt in Jerusalem in the college, and they communed with her. Okay, so folks, at this point they turn to a prophetess. Now I know that most of our first reaction to that is, yeah, and rightfully so. I don't know if you realize it or not, I went through fairly carefully. There are seven prophetesses named in the Bible. Five of them are good enough. Two of them are bad. One of the bad ones was Jezebel. One of the bad ones was Noadiah in Nehemiah. But you had Miriam. She was said to be a prophetess. That's Aaron and Moses' sister. You had Deborah in Judges 4, who was said to be a prophetess. You had Huldah here. Isaiah went into a prophetess and had a son by her. And then Anna in Luke chapter 2, the one that prophesied of Christ, was said to be a prophetess. Now, what you gather from that is you can name, or at least you're told of, a lot more prophets than prophetesses. And what the thing to gather from that is frankly, sometimes God is forced to use somebody he doesn't really want to. And I don't mean that ugly or bad or mean. I mean, after all, in this day and age, the Bible says, for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, that a woman is supposed to be covered, and her hair is given her for a covering, but that she can pray and prophesy. Now, folks, that prophesying is not getting up in church and blabbering. That is made plain in 1 Timothy. It's made plain in Titus, okay? In fact, a woman's not to stand in authority and teach men, okay, in a church. It's just the way it is. You say, why? Because that's how the Lord has it set up. You say, well, why not? For the same reason men can't have babies. That's the way the Lord has it set up. Okay, I wish, you know, if, I don't wish it was different, but I didn't make the rule. It's not me. And like I said, the bottom line is what you have to kind of acknowledge at each one of those times. The Lord was pretty hard up to find a man, and a lot of times, in this case, apparently there was not a man around, and so the Lord would turn to a prophetess at times. I don't have any other better explanation for it than that. The New Testament talks about women being silent in the church insofar as, you know, group meetings, and insofar as the Corinthians church, of course, is making scenes and all kinds of stuff going on in there. And so, you know, it's pretty fair and pretty clear. Nonetheless, Huldah here is one of the quote-unquote good guys. But there's seven prophetesses. Five are good enough. Two are bad. Now, it says down in verse 14 that she dwelt in Jerusalem in the college. I don't think it was a junior college or a community college or anything like that. You've heard before of an electoral college. Electoral college is all the electors get together, presumably, you know, in one spot, and then eventually vote, right? It's a gathering. That's what college means. It's a gathering. Now, what she's doing, dwelling in Jerusalem in the college, I really don't know. But anyway, it's a gathering of some sort. Verse 15. And she said to them, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, tell the man that sent you to me, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon this place, and upon the inhabitants thereof, even all the words of the book which the king of Judah hath read. Because they have forsaken me and have burned incense unto other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall be kindled against this place and shall not be quenched. Verse 18. But to the king of Judah, which sent you to inquire of the Lord, thus shall ye say to him, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, as touching the words which thou hast heard. And remember that each time this thing comes up, it's about these words, these words, these words. It's not about the word out there, some esoteric thing. It's about the words they heard. Nobody questioned whether the words they heard were the very words of God. And there's no reason for you to question that either. Okay? Verse 18, but to the king of Judah, which sent you to inquire of the Lord, thus shall ye say to him, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, as touching the words which thou hast heard. Because thine heart was tender, and thou hast humbled thyself before the Lord, when thou heardest that I spake against this place, and against the inhabitants thereof, and that they should become a desolation and a curse, and hast rent thy clothes and wept before me. As I understand it, I mean, that was what the humbling involved, the rending of the clothes and the weeping before him. I also have heard thee, saith the Lord. You know, one of the things you have to appreciate about your God is he can come down pretty hard, and by the time it's all over with, he does come down hard. I mean, when he runs out of patience and the threshold is crossed, things can get bad. But in all these cases, here you have these individual kings who get right. Here's Manasseh, and he is still known, I mean, after it's all said and done, he was still known as the worst king, the most longest reigning king, and the worst king that Israel ever had. Yet at the end of his life, he got right with God, and the Lord had mercy on him. And it just happens over and over again. Here in this case, here is Josiah. There's no real benefit to the Lord putting off until Josiah's dead, you know, bringing judgment upon Israel. But because Josiah got right, he did. It's just an amazing thing. The Lord seems willing over and over again to put off the anger for a while and give somebody a little bit more slack in the rope. And you can thank the Lord for that, right? Aren't you glad he didn't keep you on a real short leash? All right, verse 20. Behold, therefore, I will gather thee unto thy fathers, and thou shalt be gathered unto thy grave in peace, and thine eyes shall not see all the evil which I will bring upon this place. And they brought the king word again. Now, he does bring evil upon the place. That begins right after Josiah dies. But for now, it's still really good going. Josiah takes this and runs with it. You know, you ought to take encouragement because you live in Laodicea. We live in a day where people are almost completely self-consumed. We are rich, increased with goods, and have need of nothing if you're not really careful. And, you know, it's hard to get anything like revival going because you can't get enough people as coals together to make a hot fire. But you know what? You can be the exception, and the Lord will bless you for being the exception. You do not have to cave in to the spirit of the day. You don't. All right, 23:1. And the king sent, and they gathered unto him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem. This didn't stop him at all. I mean, he got word that because he had cried and rent his garments, that the Lord was going to be good to him, and that he wouldn't see the evils that were going to come upon Jerusalem until, you know, he wasn't going to see it because he was going to be dead before it happened. And, you know, he could have kicked back, you know, kind of like Hezekiah kind of did that. Well, it's just good that I won't see it in my day. But that's not what he did at all. If anything, he turned up the heat on this thing, right? Verse 2, and the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant. I bet that was one of the few times, if ever, that ever happened in Israel or Judah, where the king got up and read the Bible to the people. Verse 23:2 at the end of the verse. He read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant, which was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all their heart and with all their soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people stood to the covenant. And again, all the words of this covenant that were written in this book. I mean, the words that were written down. You have words that are written down. And those words that are written down, if you have the right Bible, are the words of the Lord. Now, you can buy a Bible that has some of the words of the Lord in it. You can buy plenty of Bibles that don't have them all. That's where I'm still at, okay? But you are no different than these people. You have access to those things. The Lord said you are not to let them depart from your eyes. Verse 4, and the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priests of the second order, and the keepers of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal. So not only do they have idols inside there and groves, but they have all these vessels. And basically the Lord's house has become just a zoo of false gods and false idols and all that. It's you'll be able to see that in a minute. And for all of the host of heaven, well, I picked up in the middle there, but all the vessels, right, that were made for Baal and for the grove, see that, the grove, over and over, it's the grove. It's, it's a group of trees together to be worshipped under. Those groves were a constant problem. Up on every high hill and under every green tree, there's just something about those things that promoted idolatry. And he burned them without Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried the ashes of them unto Bethel. Kidron is the river and the little in the valley that runs between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives, where the Lord Jesus Christ left on the east side of Jerusalem. You go down in this valley, cross Kidron, and go back up the Mount of Olives. And that's where he did that. And then he took them up to Bethel, the place where Jeroboam set his calf, and that's where he strewed out the ashes of them. Verse 5, and he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah. So he immediately sticks his finger into the priesthood and starts taking down the priests and basically telling them to go hit the road of priests that the kings of Judah had decided to set up on their own volition. Verse 5. Them also that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun, and to the moon, and to the planets, and to all the hosts of heaven. They're burning incense to Baal. They're burning incense to the sun. Every heathen culture around has sun worship in one level or another. It's the great life giver. It's where we get all of our energy. All you have to do is pick up a grade school science book, and they'll say that somewhere in there. It's easy to make it a god. And because the moon is what's up at night, it's easy to turn it into something idolatrous. And to the planets, and to all the hosts of heaven. That goes beyond the planets and the stars. That goes all the way up to the created, fallen creation. Creatures in heaven, the host of heaven. Verse 6, and he brought out the grove from the house of the Lord without Jerusalem unto the brook Kidron and stamped it at the brook Kidron and stamped it small to powder and cast the powder thereof upon the graves of the children of the people. And he brake down the houses of the Sodomites. I knew I'd get an amen here somewhere. That were by the house of the Lord where the women wove hangings for the grove. And again, you got this grove here. You have women weaving hangings and sodomites involved. Now, actually, I got thinking about the sodomite thing just a little bit. I want to show you something. I don't know if you know this or not. Looking at that, you should know that, just so you know, sodomites only shows up 5 times in the Bible. Okay, it's only 5 times. This is the last time it actually occurs in the Bible. All right? Now, when you look at sodomite and you look at Sodom, the kinship is very plain, right? Now, I know you don't know Hebrew, and just so you know something, I don't do much Hebrew stuff at all, but the only time I do Hebrew and Greek is to back up the King James Bible. And I want to show you something here. Your conclusion, I imagine, looking at those two words, is that those two words, if you went to the Hebrew, would be kin. Don't you think? Wouldn't you figure they would come from the same root? They don't. At all. They're nothing like kin. The word Sodom, if you transliterated it out of Hebrew, is something like Sedum or something like that. Sodomite is an entirely different Hebrew word. It's something like Kodesh or Kadesh or something like that. Okay? Now, we went through stuff like this in defense of the King James Bible, the defense of the AV, in our Bible Institute. We went through quite a bit of time, and just buckle your seatbelts here, because I believe that sometimes you get something out of the English that you don't get out of the Hebrew if you knew the original Hebrew. I believe you get something out of the English King James Bible that you wouldn't get if you knew the original Greek. We showed a whole bunch of places like that, and this is a classic place like that. For instance, why in the world would somebody, if these two words in Hebrew are nothing even like kin, why would you translate sodomite and it's not even anything like kin to Sodom? It's kind of funny, because if you read, 5 places sodomite occurs, right? Or sodomites. Five times. If you look at the New American Standard, Today's Living Bible, the RSV, the NIV, and so on and so forth, you get a couple of times, but only a couple, where it says homosexuals. It uses the term male cult prostitute or shrine prostitute in those places. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm reading along, and if I'm reading the Bible and it says a male cult prostitute, I'm like, what? Or shrine prostitute. Well, I mean, I know what a prostitute is, but what exactly does that mean? When I read sodomite, I know what it means. Why? Because even though in Hebrew those two words aren't kin, I believe God led the King James translators, like he did in scores and scores, hundreds and hundreds of other places, so that you'd be able to get it. Do you have any question about what sodomites did? Why? Because the King James translators connected the sin of sodomy with Sodom. And if you read Genesis, you know what they did in Sodom. It's that simple. And if you were a Hebrew head, you would not know what that was, because you'd have to translate it something else, and you wouldn't know for sure what that was. King James translators left no doubt in your mind whatsoever. In that regard, the King James Bible, the King James English, is superior to the Hebrew, because it clarifies. And folks, there are hundreds of places like this. We went through scores of them in defense of the AV. When you start looking at words like charity, all the new Bibles change charity back to love. No. There are tons of places like that. You go study agape, phileo, and eros love. You go study deaconesses in the Bible, and you know what you will learn? You will learn that the Lord cleared up in the translation of the King James Bible all those things so that there's not a question anymore. And there would be questions if you were always going back to the Greek and Hebrew. That's why I don't. I don't think there is any clarification. I have never read or been convinced by any of the reading that I have done in all of the people that go to Greek and Hebrew to clarify meanings. I have never, ever been convinced of one. You say, well, that's just you. Yeah, that's just me. Have you read as much as I have? Well, fine, then shut up. You don't have to listen to me. Just, if you're going to argue, go read for yourself then. I'm telling you that after reading for 25 years in this thing, I have not found any place where they say, well, you know, you wouldn't understand this in the King James because it's blah, blah, blah. But if you take the Greek, then you understand. And I'm going, what? I read through it, and they don't convince me at all. I'm convinced that it's clearer in English. I mean it. Folks, is English the language of a, do you know that if you're a Korean airline pilot or a Russian airline pilot, that you speak English? You have to. It's the language of the last days. Brother Christofferson will tell you that if he could stand on the street in China and preach on the street, that he could preach to 500 people at a time. Because if they hear you speaking English, they will cluster around just to hear it. Okay? Now, so you can take it or leave it. You hear all kinds of stuff about it. You hear all kinds of things. And, you know, everybody's always trying to take you back to the original languages. And you should just know that there are no original manuscripts left. They're always taking you back to the original languages and trying to clarify. I've studied it carefully. I am convinced. You may disagree. I am absolutely convinced the Lord did something special in the translation of the AV 1611. And that what he did in so many cases was clear up things that you never would have sorted out by yourself out of Greek and Hebrew. And this is a perfect case. Because those words aren't kin, and they were kind enough to connect the sin of sodomy with Sodom so you'd know what was going on. These guys lived in a monastery. And that's what was going on. You didn't catch that. You didn't laugh. Okay. All right. Well, I'll go on in. Verse 7, 23:7. And he brake down the houses of the Sodomites. Now, that was ugly, huh? That was pretty mean. I mean, he wasn't terribly diverse-minded or, you know, all that kind of stuff, was he? Now, folks, I mean, I'm not saying you should go, you know, bash the Sodomites. I am saying that as the king of the land, that he did not stop short of anything necessary, and these people had to be put out. There are a lot of people that, you know, if I were king, I would put out of the ministry, I can tell you that. If I were king. I ain't king, and I'm not going to be king, right? And you can be thankful for that. But because, you know, folks, you don't need heretics and perverts in the ministry. But that's a lot of what a lot of people are in the ministry. Anyway, verse 7. I'm making some of you uncomfortable. Verse 7, and he break down the houses of the Sodomites that were by the house of the Lord. Hey, folks, if you were king or if you were God, you'd be doing some things too. Just thank the Lord that that's never going to happen until Jesus comes again. So, he break down the houses of the Sodomites that were by the house of the Lord where the women wove hangings for the grove. It's just idolatry. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense from Geba to Beersheba, and break down the high places of the gates that were in the entering in of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on a man's left hand at the gate of the city. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they did eat of the unleavened bread among their brethren. And he defiled Topheth. Topheth is a place down the south side of Jerusalem. And we'll keep reading here. He defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or daughter pass through the fire to Molech. Now, if you want a little interesting study in numerology in verse 10, Topheth happens 10 times in the Bible. 10 is a Gentile number. It's just Gentile idolatry. Hinnom happens 13 times in the Bible. Molech happens 10 times in the Bible. Gentile number. It's just idolatry, rebellion. Verse 11, and he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun at the entering in of the house of the Lord. They dedicated their horses to the sun. By the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the chamberlain, which was in the suburbs, and burned the chariots of the sun with fire. They're Baal worshippers. They're sun god worshippers. And so they dedicate their horses and their chariots and their children, a little bit of everything else, to the sun. Verse 12, and the altars that were on the top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which the kings of Judah had made, and the altars which Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Man, Manasseh went in there to the courts, to the court of the Lord, and raised up altars to false gods. Did the king beat down and break them down from thence and cast the dust of them into the brook Kedron? By the way, the brook Kedron shows up 10 times too. And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon the king of Israel had builded for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of the children of Ammon, did the king defile. The Mount of Corruption, it's said to be before Jerusalem, and best guess is the Mount of Corruption is the Mount of Olives. Because if you're going east to west, you're going to enter Jerusalem, and that's how the Lord's going to go, east to west, to enter Jerusalem, then that mount would be the Mount of Olives. So the place where Jesus Christ went and resorted to, you know, the last night of his life was the place that was known at this time as the Mount of Corruption. There's a bunch of idols and stuff up there. Anyway, verse 13, all those false gods, Ashtaroth, we've talked about her before, Chemosh, Milcom, the abomination of the children of Ammon, did the king defile. And he break in pieces the images and cut down the groves and fill their places with the bones of men. Moreover, the altar that was at Bethel. Now, this is the holy place. This was the ultimate holy place for the idolaters, because that was one of the places that King Jeroboam had set up one of the calves, Bethel. Bethel was the place where the Lord, where Jacob met the Lord, called it Bethel. Went back later and called it El Bethel, not only the house of God, but the God of the house of God. And then, long after Jacob's time, then along comes King Jeroboam and defiles it, puts a false god there, and the Lord never forgave Israel for that. But that's Bethel. So, moreover, verse 15, the altar that was at Bethel, and the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, had made, both that altar and the high place, he broke down and burned the high place, stamped it small to powder, and burned the grove. Now, folks, you want to talk about prophesying? Look in 1 Kings chapter 13. Remember, we're in 2 Kings 22. 1 Kings chapter 13. 1 Kings 13:1. This is during Jeroboam's time. And watch this. 13:1. Behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel. And Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. And he cried against the altar and the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a child shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah, by name. And upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. That's prophesied, you know, hundreds of years beforehand, all the way back in 1 Kings 13. Sure enough, along comes Josiah and does that very thing. 2 Kings 23, verse 16. 2 Kings 23, 16. And as Josiah turned himself, he spied the sepulchers that were there in the mount and sent and took the bones out of the sepulchers and burned them upon the altar. I mean, opens up the graves and pulls men's bones out of there and burns them because they're idolatrous priests and stuff. I mean, you'd cause a riot in America if somebody pulled that stuff, right? But he was serious. Verse 16, burned them upon the altar and polluted it according to the word of the Lord which the man of God proclaimed who proclaimed these words. Then he said, what title is that that I see? And the men of the city told him, it is the sepulcher of the man of God which came from Judah, back in 1 Kings 13, and proclaimed these things that thou hast done against the altar of Bethel. And he said, let him alone, let no man move his bones. So they left his bones alone with the bones of the prophet that came out of Samaria. Who's that? You got the prophet from Judah, right? But then there's another prophet that came out of Samaria. It doesn't name him. I think it's Elisha. Elisha was from Samaria and died in Israel. Best guess, it's Elisha. Verse 19. And all the houses also of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria, which the king of Israel had made to provoke the Lord to anger, Josiah took away and did to them according to all the acts that he had done in Bethel. And he slew all the priests of the high places. I mean, folks, this guy, he's not just cleaning the house, he's killing idolatrous priests that were there upon the altars and burned men's bones upon them and returned to Jerusalem. And the king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover unto the Lord your God. Let's turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 35, and there's a lengthier passage regarding this. 2 Chronicles chapter 35. 2 Chronicles 35, 1. Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem, and they killed a Passover on the 14th day of the first month. They set the priests in their charges and encouraged them in the service of the house of the Lord and said unto the Levites that taught all Israel, which were holy unto the Lord, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, did build. It shall not be a burden upon your shoulders. Serve now the Lord your God and his people Israel. Prepare yourselves by the houses of your fathers after your courses according to the writing of David, king of Israel, and according to the right of Solomon, his son. Writing of Solomon's son. Stand in the holy place according to the divisions of the families of the fathers of your brethren, the people after the divisions of the families of the Levites. So kill the Passover, sanctify yourselves, and prepare your brethren that they may do according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And Josiah gave the people of the flock lambs and kids, all for the Passover offerings, for all that were present, to the number of 30,000 and 3,000 bullocks. These were of the king's substance. And his princes gave willingly unto the people, to the priests and to the Levites, Hilkiah and Zechariah and Jehiel, rulers of the house of God, gave unto the priests for the Passover offerings 2,600 small cattle and 300 oxen. Conaniah also, and Shemaiah, and Nethaneel his brethren, and Hashabiah, and Jael, and Jozabad, chief of the Levites, gave unto the Levites for Passover offerings 5,000 small cattle, 500 oxen. So the service was prepared. I mean, they were real animal rights people back then, weren't they? So the service was prepared. The priests stood in their place, and the Levites in their courses according to the king's commandment, and they killed the Passover. And the priests sprinkled the blood from their hands, and the Levites flayed them. And they removed the burnt offerings that they might give according to the division of the families of the people to offer unto the Lord, as it is written in the book of Moses, and so did they with the oxen. They roasted the Passover with the fire according to the ordinance, but the other holy offerings sod they in pots and in cauldrons and in pans, and divided them speedily among all the people. And afterward they made ready for themselves and for the priests, because the priests of the sons of Aaron were busied in offering of burnt offerings and the fat until night. Therefore the Levites prepared for themselves, and the priests, the sons of Aaron. Say, why are you reading all this stuff? Because that day was important to the Lord. Lamb kept the Passover for generations. And the Lord's going through and recording all these things down to the names of guys that killed what animals and gave how many animals and all that. Say, why? Because it's important to the Lord. Because it foreshadowed his son. Verse 15, and the singers, the sons of Asaph, were in their place according to the commandment of David, and Asaph, and Heman, and Juduthan, the king's seer, and the porters waited at every gate, they might not depart from their service, for their brethren, the Levites, prepared for them. So all the service of the Lord was prepared the same day to keep the Passover and to offer burnt offerings upon the altar of the Lord according to the commandment of King Josiah. Now, folks, next time you come to church, and you, next time you come to church, rather than coming, having not prayed, having not prepared yourself for the Lord this morning at all, you know, just going to come dragging in, you know, hoping that the coffee will kick in before you really get to sit down and get settled in too much. Now, think about the kind of preparation that had to go into this thing. And look, you're not going to be able to prepare the same way, but you can come in awake. You can come in prepared to sing. You can come in, you know, by next week this time. You should be getting excited that tomorrow night we'll be coming back here, and Brother Carlson will be here, and you get 4 or 5 days straight of good hard preaching. You know what I'm saying? The next time, you know, you think of what, you know, those people had to go through for days on end just to get prepared to go through a ritual that merely foreshadowed Jesus Christ, you get to look back and believe on Jesus Christ who has fulfilled it all. But you got to wait for the caffeine to kick in. Kind of sad, you know? Kind of sad. Anyway, verse 17, and the children of Israel that were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days. And there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the days of Samuel the prophet. Neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. And the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel that were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah was this Passover kept. The Lord remembered that day like he remembered no other. You know, Hezekiah, you know, revived the ashes and had a Passover, but even he was outdone by Josiah. All right, back to 2 Kings 23:21. The king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover unto the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of this covenant. Surely there was not holden such a Passover from the days of the judges that judged Israel. See, Samuel is one of those judges. It mentioned Samuel earlier. Nor in all the days of the kings of Israel, nor of the kings of Judah. I mean, he's accepting David and Solomon and Hezekiah here. Verse 23, but in the 18th year of King Josiah, wherein this Passover was holden to the Lord, in Jerusalem. Folks, Josiah left his mark. He left his mark in the middle of an apostate nation in an apostate time, and he did it better than King David before him. You can make your mark. You may not be able to match John Wesley's numbers or Moody's numbers, but it ain't about numbers. Verse 24. Moreover, the workers with familiar spirits. So he's picking back up where he left off. He's not done yet. Cleaning house. Moreover, the workers with familiar spirits. There's a new, I've gotten two or three, warnings about this one from various folks, links and all this. There's a new movie coming out, and I hope you weren't into the Chronicles of Narnia, and I really hope you weren't into Harry Potter. But I really hope you don't go to the route of the Golden Compass? The Golden Compass. That's the new kid movie coming out. It's kind of a Harry Potter-like one, or a Chronicles of Narnia-like movie. It's supposed to be a kid's movie. Everybody in that movie, this is an atheist, a guy that hates Christianity and so on. Everybody in that movie has a personal demon. And they name the demon talks to them, You say, what is that? That's what you're reading in 2 Kings 23:24. You read your Bible carefully, you would have read it the first time in Leviticus 17. It's a channeler. It's dealing with familiar spirits. Those are fallen angels. Those are demons. Okay? Moreover, the workers with familiar spirits and the wizards and the images and the idols and all the abominations that were spied in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem did Josiah put away, that he might perform the words of the law which were written in the book that Hilkiah the priest found in the house of the Lord. And like unto him was there no king before him that turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might according to all the law of Moses, neither after him rose there any like him. As I read that, he's ahead of Hezekiah. As I read that, there are some ways he may have been ahead of David. Verse 26, notwithstanding, we could use a few of those in this day, folks. We could use a few 13 or 14 or 15-year-olds that would grow up to be 18, 19, or 20-year-olds in this day and age that could do that. Verse 26, notwithstanding, the Lord turned not from the fierceness of his great wrath. So there comes a time, folks, where there's no remedy. And wherewith his anger was kindled against Judah, because of all the provocations that Manasseh had provoked him withal. Names a particular guy. Now, we're told we're not supposed to name names. But the Lord named names. And apparently, Manasseh was bad enough that he was willing to lay the blame on him. There were certainly apostate kings in Judah before Manasseh, but he laid it at Manasseh's feet. Verse 27, and that's after Manasseh got right. See, folks, the Lord can love you and still hate your sin, and still judge that sin. Verse 27, and the Lord said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight, as I have removed Israel, and will cast off this city, Jerusalem, which I have chosen, and the house which I said, my name shall be there. Folks, the Lord is willing to smash up what he loves for righteousness' sake. He smashed the house in Jerusalem more than once already. He sold off both the houses of Judah and Israel into bondage, brought Judah back, and sold them back after they wouldn't get right and stay right. Verse 28, now the rest of the acts of Josiah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And in his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria, to the river Euphrates, and King Josiah went against him, and he slew him. That's going to be Pharaoh Necho slew Josiah at Megiddo when he had seen him. Now that's just the opposite of Armageddon. At Armageddon, Jesus Christ comes back and slays the Antichrist. In this particular case, the type of the Antichrist comes up and slays the king of Judah. Verse 30. And his servants carried him in a chariot dead from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem and buried him in his own sepulcher. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in his father's stead. And Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. He did that which was evil in the sight. How much evil can you do in 3 months? Man, hardly get inaugurated. According to all that his fathers had done. But, I mean, folks, the Lord drew the line after Josiah. Said, man, after you, it's over. Verse 33, and Pharaoh Necho put him in bands at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem, and put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah, his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim. There's going to be several, you know, there's a Jehoahaz, a Jehoiakim, a Jeconiah. It's a little confusing. But, and he took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt, and he died there. And Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land, of everyone according to his taxation, to give it unto Pharaoh Necho. One of the earmarks of judgment is with an increasing taxation all the time. You found that in you found that in Egypt with Joseph in Egypt, but a continuing taxation. The Antichrist is said to be a raiser of taxes. In Oak Grove, we voted down the school referendum. Doesn't happen a lot, but we did. They'll be back next year. But verse 36. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Padiah of Rumah. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. And in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up. Now, I know that there's not an awful lot of deep stuff through here. We're wrapping it up, but things move fast because these guys are wicked, and the Lord's going to bring it to pass, right? So you hang in there, and then we'll slow down significantly when we get to Proverbs. But 2 Kings 24, and in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years, and he turned and rebelled against him, and the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldees, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord that he spake by his servants the prophets. You see, there's trouble. There's trouble on every side. There's just trouble all the time. Sometimes you have trouble because you're living right. But sometimes the trouble comes when the Lord's fed up, and it's just about time to wrap it up. And it's about time to wrap it up here. Surely at the commandment of the Lord came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. Remember all the way back to Abel, you know, Cain, thy brother's blood crieth to me from the ground. If you're to believe the Bible, everybody who has shed blood unjustly, that blood cries to the Lord from the ground in the land, and if those people are in prison instead of dead, that blood still cries. It's according to the Bible, okay? And so eventually, and of course, this was God's land. This was Holy Land. This is not like Minnesota or Oklahoma or Arizona or something. But if you believe the Bible, when somebody sheds blood, that the only way to make that right is that man's blood be shed itself. That's why capital punishment is right, okay? Because the blood does cry from the ground. All right, verse 4. And also for the innocent blood, verse 5. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim, all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiakim, his son, reigned in his stead. The king of Egypt came not again anymore out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt unto the river Euphrates, all that pertained to the king of Egypt. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he began to reign. He reigned in Jerusalem 3 months, and his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother, and his servants, and his princes, and his officers. And the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign. Now, there's something going on there, because in verse 8, he's 18 years old when he begins to reign, but he only reigns 3 months. But in verse 12, it takes him in the 8th year of his reign. To add confusion to that, in 2 Chronicles 36, it says that he began to reign when he was 8, not 18. We've been through this enough for you to probably be able to figure out that it had something to do with some sort of a joint reign type scenario, where in some regard he's accounted the king while his own father's still alive. That happened a lot and happened more than folks realize. Verse 13, and he carried out thence all the treasure of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon the king of Israel had made in the temple of the Lord, and as the Lord had said. And he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained save the poorest sort of the people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiakim to Babylon, and the king's mother and the king's wives and his officers and the mighty of the land. Those carried he into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. All the men of might, even 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths 1,000, all that were strong and apt for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. And the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead, and changed his name to Zedekiah. Zedekiah was 21 years old.